250 pounds of pure cocaine and 130 pounds of pure heroin to the Foreign Counterintelligence Office. These are huge quantities that exceeded the annual medical requirements of the entire German Reich many times over. Spies, however, had no authorization from the opium section of the Reich Health Office to receive these special deliveries. The lion's share went to a Department Z, which took care of the organization and administration of the Secret Service, as well as Department ZF, which was responsible for finances. The latter department, on its own, received half a ton of cocaine hydrochloride, a quantity worth millions. Might this have been a way of getting hold of foreign currency by exporting pure substances? Perhaps it was also used to bribe important contacts abroad, whom the Nazis wanted to keep on side in difficult times. In December 1943, the Army medical inspector wrote an urgent letter to put a stop to these clandestine deals. He prohibited the distribution for any reason other than healing purposes in the usual doses. This demand didn't impress the head of counterintelligence, Admiral Wilhelm Canaris. In April 1944, 4.4 pounds of cocaine hydrochloride, 3.3 pounds of morphine hydrochloride, and 7 ounces of heroin were delivered to SS Sonderkommando Wimmer in North Africa, which was carrying out the sabotage operations against the Allies in the Sahara and possibly doing a thriving drug trade at the same time. The deliveries to the Secret Service were made on the express wishes of the recipients. They wanted Merck's cocaine in its original packaging, that internationally popular product from Darmstadt. What was done with it has not as yet been discovered. One Reich, one dealer. Patient B. Either you give up smoking or you give up me. Adolf Hitler to Eva Braun. When General Field Marshal Erich von Manstein demanded at the briefing session on January 4, 1944, that the front on the Dnieper River bend be drawn back to avoid a further military disaster, Hitler became so worked up that because of spasms, he called for Morell, who gave him a restorative Eucadol injection that calmed him down. On the same day, the Red Army crossed the 1939 eastern Polish border and marched relentlessly toward the German Reich. 5 days later, Hitler once again demanded the strong opioid for flatulence, excitement, as Morell recorded. And when the dictator had to speak to his people shortly afterward in a radio address, the doctor noted, "Afternoon, 5:40 p.m., before big speech, radio for tomorrow, injection as always." At the end of February 1944, the Wehrmacht was on the point of having to retreat from the whole of Ukraine, and Hitler was holed up in the snowy Berghof, his frozen, cloud-cuckoo land of a home in Obersalzberg, where his lover Eva, 19 years his junior, was staying. A place where he could watch ravens and perform his wearying impersonations of the sounds made by different machine guns used in the Second World War. Whether he did so high or not, we cannot tell. And at tea time, there was always steaming hot streusel cake made from a family recipe by Morell's wife, Hani, the best streusel cooken in the world. Dense snow was falling outside the enormous panoramic window of the big drawing room. Opposite was the mystical Untersberg, which lay covered in white, glittering in the winter light. Legend had it that the Emperor Barbarossa slept there until his resurrection and the reinstatement of a glorious Reich. Since the defeat in Stalingrad, Hitler had an almost physical dread of snow and called it the Shroud of the Mountains. The Führer barely stepped outside the door. In any case, the situation offered little comfort to the Germans. The Russians, clearly resistant to the cold, were preparing to retake the Crimea, and the coolly rational British were bombing Berlin and other cities in the frozen Reich. Germany's former allies, Bulgaria, Romania, and Hungary, threatened to break away from Hitler, and defeats accumulated everywhere. In Italy, the Allies were marching northward, slowly but inexorably. Successful field marshals like von Manstein and Paul von Kleist were dismissed because they persisted in expressing views of their own. Hitler's personal physician certainly wasn't fired. Quite the contrary. On February 24, 1944, his patient awarded him the Knight's Cross of the War Merit Cross, While bestowing him with this high honor, Hitler described him as a gifted doctor, the savior of his life, and a pioneering but misunderstood researcher in the field of vitamins and hormones. By way of thanks, a short time later, the freshly decorated physician gave his patient Vitamaltin injections for the first time for fatigue and freshness. Before the injection, very tired and exhausted, without sleep. After that, very lively. 2 hours discussion with Reich Foreign Minister. In the evening, over dinner, very fresh compared with midday, very lively discussion. Führer extremely pleased. Morell also treated Eva Braun, more often now. Patient B made the work easy for him, as she demanded the same medication as patient A in order to be on the same wavelength as her lover. In his hormone dispensation, however, Morell made an exception from this synchronization. Hitler received testosterone for his libido, while Braun was given medication to suppress menstruation so that, quite literally speaking, their chemistry was right, and they could at least enjoy some sexual success in the momentary breaks between increasingly lengthy military briefings. At any rate, that was what Hitler strived for, despite rumors to the contrary. He even on occasion claimed that relationships outside marriage were in many respects superior, since they were rooted in natural sexual attraction. He seemed convinced of the beneficial effect of physical love. Without sex, he claimed, there was no art, no painting, and no music. No civilized nation, Catholic Italy included, could manage without extramarital intercourse. Morell, in turn, provided indirect information about the kind of copulation performed at the Berghof when he stated after the war that Hitler had sometimes canceled medical investigations to conceal wounds on his body from Eva Braun's aggressive sexual behavior. Outwardly, the image of a healthy, Führer world was widespread even in the spring of 1944, in spite of the disastrous military situation. The Berghof, whose walls were hung with the works of old masters, played an important part in the dissemination of propaganda and contributed considerably to the continuing media implementation of the Führer cult. When the man and his faithful German shepherd Blondi stood at the edge of the forest in early spring, gazing into the distance, Braun, personally trained by the official Reich photographer Heinrich Hoffmann, was always there, having chosen his ties beforehand. Issuing instructions on how Hitler should pose, she put her Agva Movex into action. Even today, clips shot by Braun still circulate on the internet. Anyone who sees these pictures might think that Hitler was the most ascetic, conscientious, modest person in the world. No hard drugs are injected. Instead, fawns come into view, or failing that, children are stroked and Easter eggs hidden, while the self-justifying Speer paces back and forth on the terrace in his light gray pinstripe. The personal doctor can also be seen munching cake and putting a brave face on things. But when Eva Braun turned the camera off, the masks fell straight away, and she again started digging her fingernails into her forearm and biting her lips until they bled, while Hitler's hand shook so much when he was drinking apple tea that the cup rattled on the saucer, embarrassing everyone. As for Morell, he was so run down by now that he could hardly climb a flight of stairs. Admittedly, the personal physician found no rest because everyone needed him. Going to see the fat doctor was part of bon ton. Meanwhile, his patients had come to include all the top-ranking officials of the Reich and their allies. He treated Mussolini, who was given the code name Patient D. Industrialists like Alfred Krupp or August Thyssen. Fee for treatment, 20,000 Reichsmarks. Many Gauleiter and Wehrmacht generals. Leni Riefenstahl, who was given morphine enemas. The SS chief Himmler. The foreign minister Joachim von Ribbentrop, Patient X, or Ribbon Shit, as American intelligence later nicknamed him. The minister of armaments, Albert Speer. The Japanese ambassador, General Hiroshi Oshima, and the wife of Reich Marshal Göring, who had injections on alternate days of Vitamaltin Forte, whatever was hidden behind that label. More and more influential National Socialists made the pilgrimage to Morell, even if it was only a way of announcing their closeness to Hitler and confirming their own position. Above all, of course, Hitler claimed the time of his personal physician, and Morell, who was himself in poor health by now, complained to the wife of the economics minister, Walter Funk, another patient, "At all times of day and night I have to follow the instructions that I get from above. At the moment I drive up to the Führer at noon to possibly give him treatment, and come back to the hotel at almost 2 o'clock in the afternoon to lie in bed all day so that I'm able to accompany the Führer again the following day." By now Morell was hooked on the needle himself, and his assistant, Dr. Richard Weber, had to travel from Berlin to the remote Berghof, as he is the best at giving injections and the only one guaranteed to find my veins. What Morell was treating himself with is not recorded. Illnesses, medicines, and mass murder defined everyday life at the Berghof in the first half of 1944. The bowling alley, still an attraction in the 1930s, was hardly used now. Camouflage nets hung over the famous panoramic window because of the constant fear of air raids. Everyone vegetated in an eternal twilight, sitting around, either by a stove on the bench or in expensive armchairs, staring at the dust-gathering Gobelin tapestries, vampire-like figures who had a fear of natural light. Even when the sun shone outside, the electric lamps were burning inside. The thick carpets gave off a musty smell. The Supreme Commander of the Navy came for the Führer's 55th birthday. Grand Admiral Karl Dönitz reported on the establishment of a special unit with miracle weapons, brought models of new mini-submarines as a present, and asked his commander-in-chief to do everything to keep the Baltic ports open in return. Hitler, as mad for boats as a child for toys, blindly promised Dönitz that he would. On his birthday, patient A's personal physician injected him with a cocktail of X, Vitamaltin Forte, camphor, and the plant-based coronary prophylactic strophanthin, followed the next morning by an injection of Prostrophanta, a concoction for heart conditions made by Morell's company Hama. There were also intravenous injections of glucose, more Vitamaltin, and as the cherry on the cake, a homemade preparation of parasite liver, whose intramuscular injection would immediately brand a medical practitioner today as a quack and possibly put him behind bars. Patient A sincerely thanked his physician as the only one who could help him. The birthday party was disturbed only by an air raid warning. The sirens wailed, the big artificial fog device was turned on, and the Berghof, that refuge from reality, sank into artificial whiteness like a nightmare version of mystic Avalon, cut off from the world by an opaque veil. For fear of damage to his heart and ever greater breathlessness from discharged gas, Morell briefly fled to the valley. Everything was back to normal at dinner time. Hitler had once again demonstrated his moral superiority by describing his guests' beef bouillon as corpse brew, ate some Hartz Mountain cheese with spinach pudding, stuffed gherkins, barley gruel, kohlrabi balls, and 6 Vitamaltin bars, as well as Uflat and anti-gas pills for his flatulence, and a pig's heart muscle extract in phosphoric acid as a general tonic. After dinner, the supposed vegetarian dozed off briefly while gripping his knife, his hands folded over his belly. His magical doctor's terrible table manners were still the stuff of legend. Having downed his obligatory glass of port, Morell also leaned back in his armchair and closed his eyes behind his thick spectacle lenses. As always, he closed them from bottom to top, a feared, gruesome-looking oddity of Morell's. Both men had weak hearts, and both were gradually growing old. Eva Braun had lit the fire and put on an American jazz record. She wanted to watch Gone with the Wind for the 1,000th time because of her affinity for Clark Gable, her favorite actor. With stolen gold from Jewish fillings lining his mouth, Reichsleiter Bormann brushed the idea aside with a cynical smile. "The Führer doesn't need the relaxation of a movie. What he needs is a powerful shot." Morell gave a start, thought someone was talking to him, was ashamed of his sleepiness, and quickly told everyone a story from the old days, from his time as a ship's doctor in Africa, which they all knew anyway. Then apple cake was served. After eating, Hitler's stomach cramps were eased with Yukodol in his private quarters. "When I put this into your vein, please start slowly counting. Once you have reached 15, you won't feel any more pain. In the weeks after his birthday, while the Red Army prepared Operation Bagration, which would free their way to East Prussia from the end of June 1944, Hitler's health deteriorated further. Eva, usually accompanied by her Scotch terriers, Stasi and Negus, was more and more appalled by the worsening appearance and increasingly frail constitution of her long-term lover. When she criticized him for walking with a stoop, he tried to play down his unstoppable decline by joking that he was carrying heavy keys in his pocket. His knees were now obviously trembling when he stood on the balcony for more than a few moments, the two of them looking out on a clear day at the reddening sky above far-off burning Munich, and Eva wondering fearfully whether her smart little house, which Hitler had bought for her in the elegant district of Bogenhausen, was still standing. Hitler was nearly finished off, and Goebbels had probably seldom lied more shamelessly when he wrote in his diary entry for June 6, 1944, the day of the Allied Normandy landings, "Professor Morel is helping me a little to improve the slightly weakened state of my health. He has also been a strong support to the Führer's health recently. At my meeting with the Führer, I can confirm that he looks dazzling and that he is in good spirits." In fact, Hitler's mood on D-Day, another nail in the coffin for the Nazi state, was subject to severe fluctuations. At 9 a.m, he is said to have bellowed across the breakfast room, "Is this the invasion or isn't it?" When Morel hurried over and gave him an injection of X, he calmed down, suddenly appeared affable and lighthearted, enjoyed the day and the fine weather, and clapped everyone he met jovially on the shoulder. At the midday briefing, in spite of the looming military disaster, to everyone's astonishment, he revealed a beaming face, and at the lunch that followed, semolina dumpling soup, mushrooms in a ring of rice, Apfelstrudel, he fell into one of his endless distracted monologues. This time it was about elephants, which were the strongest animals in existence and which, like him, abhorred meat. Next, Hitler described in detail the horrors of a slaughterhouse he had visited in occupied Poland. Girls in rubber boots had waded in blood up to their ankles. Meanwhile, Morel was preparing his next injection, made from the glands of slaughtered animals. On the evening of June 6th, Hitler still didn't believe that the invasion on the Atlantic North Coast was actually happening, but was satisfied with the idea that this was just a mock assault, a decoy maneuver designed to provoke him into overhasty reactions. This was not the case. In fact, the Allies had established themselves along substantial stretches of coast by the end of the day and taken the Germans by surprise. The Western Front opened up. In military terms, the German Reich now had no chance at all. But there was something that cheered Hitler up that day. Goebbels had at last given up smoking. On July 14, 1944, the Führer left his Berghof forever. During the flight to the wolf's lair, the curtains remained closed. Patient A had flu and conjunctivitis in both eyes. Head water, hydrocephalus, has flowed into his left eye. He was given an adrenaline solution as well as reports on the advances of the Allies through France, the approach of the Red Army toward the border of the Reich, and the latest bombing raids on German cities. He struggled to put on his reading glasses to be able to decipher all the bad news. He didn't look down from the plane window. Operation Valkyrie and its pharmacological consequences. The park around the wolf's lair was resplendent with lush green. The summer was hot, the forest shimmered, and Theo Morel fastened a facial mosquito net over the visor of his fantastical uniform cap. The wooden barracks of the Führer's headquarters had been given a splinter shield of strong reinforcing walls. Goebbels was smoking again, and on July 20, 1944, patient A, 1114 injection as always. On the file card, the procedure is recorded as X. Pharmacologically pepped up, Hitler ran to the ground floor building in which the military briefing was being held on this fateful day. Some officers were already waiting outside the door. The dictator drew his strong eyebrows together so that the ridge above them became more defined and shook hands with everyone around him. He then stepped into the interior of the barrack, whose windows were open against the oppressive heat. While the remaining 24 participants were grouped around a long oak table, he alone sat down on a stool and began to play with a magnifying glass. Lieutenant General Adolf Heusinger, who stood on his right, morbidly described the desolate situation on the Eastern Front. Klaus Schenk Graf von Stauffenberg, who had arrived a little late, shook hands with Hitler, shoved his brown briefcase under the table as close to his target as possible. A little later, he left the room again, inconspicuously. At 12:41, an admiral walked to one of the windows to get fresh air. Hitler bent low over the table so that he could get a better view of the map, resting his chin on his hand, his elbow on the tabletop. It was 12:42. The general was explaining, "If the army group doesn't come back from Lake Peipus at last, there will be a catastrophe." There was a terrible explosion. I saw a bright, clear, jetting, infernal flame, and thought to myself that it could only be an English explosive. German explosives do not have such an intense, bright yellow flame. Hitler's own description of events sounds strangely detached, as if spoken from behind a veil. The blast sent him flying from the middle of the room to the door. Wired on X, the dictator may have experienced the explosion as if wrapped up in cotton wool, and felt as invulnerable as Wagner's Siegfried. While all around him, the seriously wounded officers fought for their lives, their hair in flames. As if he were just a bystander, he reported that a moment later, "I couldn't see anything clearly through the thick smoke. I saw only a few figures lying in the haze and moving. I was lying in the barrack near the left doorpost, on top of me a few slats and beams, but I was able to get up and go on my own. I was just a little dizzy and slightly dazed." Morel heard the explosion from his workspace and immediately assumed it must be a bomb. Moments later, Hitler's valet, Heinz Linge, came rushing in. The professor had to come quickly to the Führer. The physician hastily picked up his black case and lumbered heavily out into the sultry summer air. A general lay on the floor with one leg torn off and one eye lost. Morel wanted to stop and tend to him, but Linge dragged him on. The Führer was more important. It didn't take them long to reach Hitler, who presented a grotesque picture, smiling blithely and sitting on his bed even though his forehead was bloody, his hair was burnt off at the back of his scalp, and there was a saucer-sized burn on his calf. "Keitel and Warlimont led me to my bunker," the dictator reported with a lively, almost cheerful expression. "On the way I saw that my trousers were badly torn, and that bare flesh was visible everywhere. Then I washed because my face looked like a Moor's, and then changed my clothes." When Hitler pointed out that Mussolini was coming for an important state visit in 2 hours, Morel took out his tools and injected X again. That it was just glucose and not an effective painkiller seems hardly likely. Patient A had dozens of splinters in his body, and these now had to be removed individually, a painful procedure. But Hitler wasn't bothered. His two burst eardrums were bleeding, but even that didn't trouble him, and he impressed everyone with his apparent courage. On the medical file for patient A, Morel recorded that Hitler hadn't been agitated in the slightest. His pulse was normal, as always. Nonetheless, the physician recommended that he stay in bed. But Hitler, full of beans from his injection, was already standing in freshly polished boots and announced that it was ridiculous for a healthy man to receive guests in bed. Wrapped in a bulging black cloak, he went to the Wolf's Lair railway station and waited impatiently for Mussolini, who said, dumbfounded by Hitler's apparent physical integrity, "That was a sign from heaven." In reality, Hitler had been more severely affected than it at first appeared. He had lost his hearing almost entirely, and he began to have severe pains in his arms and legs as the effects of X abated in the evening. Blood was still flowing uninterruptedly from both ears. Psychologically, the attack had devastating consequences. In the traditional day-on, day-off rhythm, patient A now received his X against the pain and the shock to his nerves. In this critical phase after the attempted coup, he couldn't afford to miss a dose. However, the presentation of Hitler as an invincible, even invulnerable hero didn't always work. When he welcomed a group of army officers a week later, their excited cries of "Heil Hitler!" died away when they laid eyes on him as he entered the room. All of a sudden, the gap between the fiction of the Führer and the real-life Hitler was all too apparent. At last, cocaine. O night, I took some cocaine, and blood dispersion is underway. Hair turns gray, the years flee. I must in ardor blossom once again before I decay. Gottfried Benn. Because of the injury to both eardrums, word was sent to the nearby reserve field hospital to bring Dr. Erwin Giesing, an ear, nose, and throat specialist, to the wolf's lair. He too quickly realized what was happening in the senior echelons. Although he had been told before their first meeting that Hitler was a kind of powerful mystical Superman, it was a bent, halting figure that he met, wearing a dark blue striped dressing gown and slippers on his bare feet. Giesing described his impressions precisely. The face was pale, slightly swollen, and there were large bags under both bloodshot eyes. The eyes did not make the fascinating impression so often ascribed to them in the press. I was particularly struck by the wrinkles from either side of the nose to the outer corner of the mouth, and by the dry, slightly cracked lips. His hair was already clearly mixed with gray and rather unkempt. The face was well-shaven, but with somewhat withered skin, which I attributed to fatigue. The speech was unnaturally loud and tended toward a shout, and later became somewhat hoarse. An aged, almost depleted and exhausted man who had to make do with what was left of his strength. In a neurological respect, the specialist diagnosed the patient as normal. No hallucinations, no incontinence, functioning memory, and sense of time and space. Emotionally unstable, however, either love or hate, constant flux of thoughts, his statements always relevant, the Führer's psychological condition is very complex. Examining Hitler's burst eardrums, Giesing found a marked, sickle-shaped tear in the right ear and a smaller injury in the left. When treating the sensitive tissue with acid, he admired Hitler's extraordinary impassivity. He felt no pain anymore, patient A boasted, and in any case, pain only existed to make people harder. Giesing couldn't have guessed that perhaps he didn't feel the pain because he had been given drugs by his personal physician shortly beforehand. There were no discussions between the two doctors, and while Giesing learned nothing from Morell about what he had administered, Morell had no idea what the new doctor was prescribing to the patient. I was not briefed by ear specialist Dr. Giesing, Morell noted sourly. The two doctors disliked each other from the first moment. When Morell approached Giesing on his arrival with the words, "Who are you? Who called you? Why didn't you report to me?" Giesing fired back, "As an officer, I only have to report to my military superiors, not to you, a civilian." After that, the top dog refused to even look at the newly recruited specialist. Giesing described the personal physician on another occasion with little sympathy and an acid pen. Morell comes in, distinctly short of breath and panting. He shakes only Hitler's hand and asks agitatedly whether anything in particular happened during the night. Hitler says no. He slept well and even digested the previous night's salad without any difficulty. Then, with the help of Linga, he takes off his coat, sits back down in his armchair, and pulls up his left sleeve. Morell gives Hitler the injections. He pulls the needle out again and wipes the puncture site with a handkerchief. Then he leaves the room and goes into the office, holding in his right hand the used syringe and in the left empty ampules, one large and two small. He goes with the ampules and the syringe into the adjacent orderly's bathroom, rinses the syringe out himself, and destroys the empty ampules by throwing them into the toilet. Then he washes his hands, comes back into the office, and says goodbye to everyone present. But Giesing didn't come to his Führer empty-handed either. His favorite remedy for treating pains in the ear, nose, and throat area was cocaine, the very substance the Nazis abhorred as a Jewish degeneration drug. This choice is not as unusual as it might seem, as not many alternatives for local anesthesia were available at the time, and cocaine was stocked as a medicine in every pharmacy. If we can believe Giesing, the only source in this case, between July 22nd and October 7th, 1944, on 75 days, he administered the substance over 50 times in the form of nose and throat dabs, a highly effective surface application. This was pure first-class stuff, the famous Merck cocaine, delivered from Berlin by courier train as an extremely psychoactive 10% cocaine solution in a sealed bottle, responsibly signed for by the SS pharmacist, in line with the regulations of the Reich Security Main Office. In the Wolf's lair, Hitler's valet kept it locked up under his personal care. Again, this obvious application of drugs is barely noticed by Hitler's biographers, even though it is worth mentioning because of its strong euphorigenic potential for the critical phase after the assassination attempt. The procedure went like this. In the morning, Assistant Surgeon Karl Brandt brought his colleague Giesing to a tent beside the guest bunker, where they went through the strict security measures in place since July 20th. Giesing's bags were emptied, every instrument was examined. Even the light bulbs of the otoscope were taken out and screwed back in again. Giesing had to hand over his uniform cap and his dagger, empty out the contents of his trouser and jacket pockets onto the table, and turn out his pockets. He got only his handkerchief and keys back, and his fountain pen and pencil were returned afterward. He was frisked from top to bottom. Cocaine was left out of these rigid controls. It was already inside. Now Linga, the valet, went into action, taking the bottle out of the drug cabinet in the orderly room and inviting Giesing to make his examination. Patient A expressed his gratitude for this variation in the menu. According to Giesing's report, he claimed that on cocaine he felt considerably lighter and carefree, and that he could also think more clearly. The doctor explained to him that the psychotropic wave was the medicinal effect on the swollen nasal mucous membrane, and that it was now easier to breathe through the nose. The effect usually lasted between 4 and 6 hours. He might have a slight cocaine sniff afterward, but it would stop after a short time. Hitler supposedly asked whether this swabbed application could not be made once or twice a day, even when the oral passages requiring treatment were healed again after September 10th. Giesing, who saw his star in the ascendant, agreed, but claims to have pointed out to the patient that all cocaine was absorbed by the nasal mucous membrane and passed into the blood supply, so he had to warn against too high a dose. But Hitler went on requesting this application, and during the next few days, in spite of profuse perspiration, he confirmed the success. "It's a good thing you're here, doctor. This cocaine is wonderful, and I'm glad that you found the right remedy. Free me from these headaches again for a while." Those headaches had probably also been caused by the constant crashing and screeching that had been putting the nerves of the residents of the innermost restricted zone of the Wolf's lair on edge for the last few days. The construction unit's jackhammers and heavy machinery were hastily erecting a new, even more strongly reinforced Führerbunker. Patient A could only bear the noise while on cocaine, and the restorative drug made him feel as if he wasn't ill at all. "Now my mind is freed again, and I feel very well." But one concern preyed on his mind. "Please don't turn me into a cocaine addict," he said to his new favorite doctor, to which Giesing replied reassuringly, "A real cocaine addict snorts dry cocaine." Hitler was heartened. "I don't intend to become a cocaine addict." So the Führer had his nose swabbed and went to the military briefing full of artificial confidence. The matter was clear as far as he was concerned. The war against the Russians would somehow be won. When he received another dose from Giesing on September 16, 1944, he had a very special brainstorm, one of those feared pseudo-genius Führer's ideas. He told his baffled entourage that despite their vast inferiority in terms of men and materials, he wanted to go back on the offensive on the Western Front. Immediately he formulated an order demanding fanatical determination from all soldiers fit for duty. Although everyone advised him against the hopeless enterprise of a second Ardennes offensive, the dictator refused to be deterred. Victory would be his. In consequence, Giesing started to feel unsettled by Hitler's affinity for cocaine, which erases all feelings of self-doubt and encourages megalomania. And he wanted to stop administering the potent swabs. But Hitler wouldn't let him. "No, doctor, continue as before. This morning I have a terrible throbbing head that probably comes from the sniffing. Concern for the future and the continued existence of Germany are consuming me more and more with each passing day." Still, Giesing's medical scruples outweighed his duty to obey, and he refused Hitler the drug. Defiantly, the Supreme Commander didn't appear at the military briefing that day, September 26, 1944. but announced huffily that he was no longer interested in the situation in the east, where the whole front threatened to collapse. Intimidated, Giesing came round and promised cocaine, but in return he demanded a full checkup of Hitler. Patient A, who had previously always forbidden such an examination, consented, and on October 1, 1944, he even appeared naked, as he had otherwise generally refused to do, solely to wheedle for himself some of that coveted blow. "Look in my nose again and put that cocaine thing in to get rid of the pressure in my head. I have important things to do today." Giesing obeyed and administered the drug, this time in such a dose that Hitler is believed to have lost consciousness, and for a short time there is supposed to have been a danger of respiratory paralysis. If the account given by Giesing is accurate, then the self-described abstainer almost died of an overdose. Speedball. Hitler responded to just about every drug, with the exception of alcohol. He wasn't dependent on one particular substance, but on substances generally that gave him access to pleasant, artificial realities. Within a very short time, he had become the most passionate consumer of cocaine, but from mid-October 1944, he was also able to abandon the drug and rely instead on other stimulants. In retrospect, Hitler, like cocaine users tend to do, shifted this phase of his existence into a dowdy pose. "The weeks since July 20th have been the hardest of my life. I have fought with a kind of heroism that no German could have dreamed of. In spite of serious pain, hours of dizziness and nausea, I have remained on my feet and fought against all of this with iron energy. I have often survived the danger of collapse, but through my will, I have always taken control of the situation." The words iron energy and will need only be replaced by Eukodol and cocaine, and we already come a little closer to the truth. The Luftwaffe adjutant, Nikolaus von Below, also used these incorrect terms when describing his Führer in the weeks after the assassination attempt. "He was sustained only by a strong will and his heightened sense of mission." In fact, it was his strong cocaine and his heightened quantity of Eukodol. Because Eukodol was now being administered in the grand style, the dosage had doubled in comparison with the previous year to 20 milligrams, almost four times the typical medical application. During those weeks, cocaine and Eukodol, the Führer's mixture, the cocktail in his blood, mutated into the classic speedball, the sedating effect of the opioid balancing the stimulating effect of the cocaine. Enormous euphoria and highs that are felt in every last fiber of the body result from this pharmacological pincer movement, in which two potent molecules with opposite biochemical effects fight for dominance in the body. This produces both a strong circulatory overload and insomnia, and the liver desperately fights against such an onslaught of poisons. During that last autumn of the war and of his life, the dictator drew on a wealth of artificial paradises. When patient A stepped onto his pharmacologically created Mount Olympus, setting his heels down first as always, bending his knees, clicking his tongue, and flapping his wrists, imagining that his thoughts were crystal clear and that he could rearrange the world to his own liking, it was impossible for his generals, more than sobered by the oppressive situation at the front, to get through to him. The medication kept the Supreme Commander stable in his delusion, built up an unassailable rampart, an impregnable defense that nothing could penetrate. Any doubts were swept away by his chemically induced confidence. The world could sink into rubble and ashes around him, and his actions cost millions of people their lives. But the Führer felt more than justified when his artificial euphoria set in. Hitler had read Goethe's Faust as a young man. In the autumn of 1944, by enjoying the fruits of the labors of Friedrich Sertürner, who discovered morphine as a young medical researcher in the days of Weimar classicism and is seen as the father of Eukodol and all other opioids, patient A entered into a pact with Mephisto once and for all. The narcotic not only rid him of his severe intestinal spasms, that was the publicly acceptable outcome, but also sweetened the moment. It is not possible to prove clinical dependence, but Morell's almost undecipherable diary for September 1944 gives us an idea of how often this hardcore drug was really administered. But beyond these records, it is by no means impossible that Eucadol made its way into Hitler's bloodstream, also as X, injection as always, or simply unrecorded. Whoever starts taking Eucadol and has ready access to it will, in most cases, never give it up again. On September 23rd, 24th to 25th, and 28th to 29th, 1944, just to examine a typical week, patient A was given the potent narcotic four times, always with a day's pause in between. This is the typical rhythm of an addict and contradicts the idea of a purely medical application. One striking feature is the combination with the anticonvulsive eupavirine, a synthetic analog of the plant-based agent papaverine from the opium poppy, which calms the muscles and is a comparatively harmless medication because it does not cause dependency. This double pack, deliberately or not, disguised what Hitler was actually consuming. For a long time, even the Führer confused the similar-sounding medications and demanded eupavirine when he actually meant Eucadol. In Morell's words, the Führer was very happy about it and gratefully pressed my hand and said, "What a stroke of luck that we have eupavirine." We can only surmise how the dictator felt after an intravenous injection of 20 milligrams of the highly potent substance, when moments after the injection, its effects were felt by the oral mucous membranes, and he got the taste or drip, as addicts call it. The energy always came suddenly, within a few seconds, and from all directions, a felicitous, enormously calming force. And when Hitler said, "Doctor, I'm so glad when you arrive in the morning," he was being unusually honest. In the morning, he got a jab that created a heightened feeling that corresponded so perfectly to his own image of greatness, and that reality no longer supplied. The Doctor's War. "You have all agreed that you want to turn me into a sick man, Adolf Hitler." The power of the personal physician was approaching a high point during that autumn of 1944. Since the attempt on his life, patient A needed him more than ever, and with each new injection, Morell gained further influence. The dictator was closer to him than he was to anyone else. There was no one he liked to talk to as much, no one he trusted more. At major meetings with the generals, an armed SS man stood behind every chair to prevent any further attacks. Anyone who wanted to see Hitler had to hand over his briefcase. This regulation did not apply to Morell's doctor's bag. Many people envied the self-styled sole personal physician his privileged position. Suspicion about him was growing. Morell still stubbornly refused to talk to anyone else about his methods of treatment. Right until the end, he maintained the discretion with which he had initially approached the post. But in the stuffy atmosphere of the haunted realm of the bunker system, where the poisonous plants of paranoia sent their creepers over the thick concrete walls, this was not without its dangers. Morell even left the assistant doctors, Karl Brandt and Hans Karl von Hasselbach, with whom he could have discussed the treatment of Hitler, consistently in the dark. He had mutated from outsider to diva. He told no one anything, wrapping himself in an aura of mystery and uniqueness. Even the Führer's all-powerful secretary, Bormann, who made it clear that he would have preferred a different kind of treatment for Hitler, one based more on biology, was banging his head against a wall when it came to the fat doctor. As the war was being lost, guilty parties were sought. The forces hostile to Morell were assembling. For a long time, Himmler had been collecting information about the physician to accuse him of having a morphine addiction and thus of being vulnerable to blackmail. Again and again, the suspicion was voiced on the quiet. Might he not be a foreign spy who was secretly poisoning the Führer? As early as 1943, the foreign minister, von Ribbentrop, had invited Morell to lunch at his castle, Fürschel, near Salzburg, and launched an attack. While the conversation with von Ribbentrop's wife initially revolved around trivial questions such as temporary marriages, state bonuses for children born out of wedlock, lining up for food, and the concomitant waste of time, after the meal, the minister stonily invited him upstairs to discuss something. Von Ribbentrop, arrogant, difficult, and blasé as always, tapped the ash off his Egyptian cigarette with long aristocratic fingers, looked grimly around the room, then fired off a cannonade of questions at the miracle doctor. Was it good for the Führer to get so many injections? Was he given anything apart from glucose? Was it, generally speaking, not far too much? The doctor gave curt replies. He only injected what was necessary. But von Ribbentrop insisted that the Führer required a complete transformation of his whole body so that he became more resilient. That was water off a duck's back for Morell, and he left the castle rather unimpressed. Laymen are often so blithe and simple in their medical judgments, he wrote, concluding his record of the conversation. But this was not the last assault Morell would bear. The first structured attack came from Bormann, who tried to guide Hitler's treatment onto regular or at least manageable lines. A letter reached the doctor, secret Reich business. In 8 points, measures for the Führer's security in terms of his medical treatment were laid out. A sample examination of the medicines in the SS laboratories was scheduled, and most importantly, Morell was ordered henceforth always to inform the medical supply officer which and how many medications he plans to use monthly for the named purpose. In fact, this remained a rather helpless approach from Bormann, who was not usually helpless. On the one hand, his intervention turned Hitler's medication into an official procedure, but on the other, he wanted as little correspondence as possible on the subject, since it was important to maintain the healthful aura of the leader of the master race. Heil Hitler literally means health to Hitler, after all. For that reason, the drugs, as detailed in Bormann's letter, were to be paid for in cash to leave no paper trail. Bormann added that the monthly packets should be stored ready for delivery at any time in an armored cupboard and made as identifiable as possible down to the ampule by consecutive numbering, for example, for the first consignment, 1/44. While at the same time the external wrapping of the package should bear an inscription to be precisely established with the personal signature of the medical supply officer. Morell's reaction to this bureaucratic attempt to make his activities transparent was as simple as it was startling. He ignored the instructions of the mighty security apparatus and simply didn't comply, instead continuing as before. In the eye of the hurricane, he felt invulnerable, banking on the assumption that patient A would always protect him. In late September 1944, in the pale light of the bunker, the ear doctor Giesing noted an unusual coloration in Hitler's face and suspected jaundice. The same day, on the dinner table, there was a plate holding apple compote with glucose and green grapes, and a box of Dr. Koester's anti-gas pills, a rather obscure product. Giesing was perplexed when he discovered that its pharmacological components included atropine, derived from belladonna or other nightshade plants, and strychnine, a highly toxic alkaloid of Nux vomica, which paralyzes the neurons of the spinal column and is also used as rat poison. Giesing indeed smelled a rat. The side effects of these anti-gas pills at too high a dose seemed to correspond to Hitler's symptoms. Atropine initially has a stimulating effect on the central nervous system, then a paralyzing one, and a state of cheerfulness arises with a lively flow of ideas, loquacity, and visual and auditory hallucinations, as well as delirium, which can mutate into violence and raving. Strychnine, in turn, is held responsible for increased light sensitivity and even fear of light, as well as for states of flaccidity. For Giesing, the case seemed clear. Hitler constantly demonstrated a state of euphoria that could not be explained by anything, and I am certain his heightened mood when making decisions after major political or military defeats can be largely explained in this way. In the anti-gas pills, Giesing thought he had discovered the causes of both Hitler's megalomania and his physical decline. He decided to treat himself as a guinea pig. For a few days, Giesing took the little round pills himself, promptly identified that he had the same symptoms, and decided to go on the offensive. His intention was to disempower Morell by accusing him of deliberately poisoning the Führer, so that Giesing could assume the position of personal physician himself. While the Allied troops were penetrating the borders of the Reich from all sides, The pharmacological lunacy in the claustrophobic wolf's lair was becoming a doctor's war. As his ally in his plot, Giesing chose Hitler's surgeon, who had been an adversary of Morell's for a long time. Karl Brandt was in Berlin at the time, but when Giesing called, he took the next plane to East Prussia without hesitation and immediately summoned the accused man. While the personal physician must have worried that he was being collared for Eucadol, he was practically relieved when his opponents tried to snare him with the anti-gas pills, which were available without prescription. Morell was also able to demonstrate that he had not even prescribed them, but that Hitler had organized the acquisition of the pills through his valet Linge. Brandt, who had little knowledge of biochemistry and focused his attention on the side effects of strychnine, was not satisfied with this defense. He threatened Morell. "Do you think anyone would believe you if you claimed that you didn't issue this prescription? Do you think Himmler might treat you differently from anyone else? So many people are being executed at present that the matter would be dealt with quite coldly." Just a week later, Brandt added, "I have proof that this is a simple case of strychnine poisoning. I can tell you quite openly that over the last 5 days I have only stayed here because of the Führer's illness." But what sort of illness was that exactly? Was it really icterus, jaundice? Or might it be a typical kind of junky hepatitis, because Morell wasn't using properly sterile needles? Hitler, whose syringes were only ever disinfected with alcohol, wasn't looking well. His liver, under heavy attack from those many toxic substances over the past few months, was releasing the bile pigment bilirubin, a warning signal that turns skin and eyes yellow. Morell was being accused of poisoning his patient. There was an air of threat when Brandt addressed Hitler. Meanwhile, on the night of October 5, 1944, Morell suffered a brain edema from the agitation. Hitler was unsettled beyond measure by the accusations. Treachery? Poison? Might he have been mistaken for all those years? Was he being double-crossed by his personally chosen Dr. Morell, the truest of the true, the best of all his friends? Wouldn't dropping his personal physician, who had just given him a beneficial injection of Eucadol, amount to a kind of self-abandonment? Wouldn't it leave him high and dry, vulnerable? This was an attack that might prove fatal, as his power was based on charisma. After all, it was the drugs that helped him artificially maintain his previously natural aura on which everything depended. Since the start of the Führer's rapid physical decline, these internecine struggles between the doctors turned into a proxy war for succession at the top of the Nazi state. The situation was becoming worse. Himmler told Brandt he could easily imagine that Morell had tried to kill Hitler. The Reichsführer SS called the physician to his office and coldly informed him that he had himself sent so many people to the gallows that he no longer cared about one more. At the same time in Berlin, the head of the Gestapo, Ernst Kaltenbrunner, summoned Morell's locum, Dr. Weber from the Kurfürstendamm, to a hearing at the Reich Security main office on Prinz Albrecht Straße. Weber tried to exonerate his boss and voiced his opinion that a plot was utterly out of the question. He claimed Morell was far too fearful for such a thing. Finally, the chemical analysis of the disputed medication was made available. The result, its atropine and strychnine content, was far too small to poison anyone, even in the massive quantities that Hitler had been given. It was a comprehensive victory for Morell. "I would like the matter involving the anti-gas pills to be forgotten once and for all," Hitler stated, ending the affair. "You can say what you like against Morell. He is and remains my only personal physician, and I trust him completely." Giesing received a reprimand, and Hitler dismissed him with the words that all Germans were freely able to choose their doctors, including himself, the Führer. Furthermore, it was well known that it was the patient's faith in his doctor's methods that contributed to his cure. Hitler would stay with the doctor he was familiar with and brushed aside all references to Morell's lax treatment of the syringe. "I know that Morell's new method is not yet internationally recognized, and that Morell is still in the research stage with certain matters, without having reached a firm conclusion about them. But that has been the case with all medical innovations. I have no worries that Morell will not make his own way, and I will immediately give him financial support for his work if he needs it." Himmler, a dedicated sycophant, immediately changed tack. "Yes, gentlemen," he explained to Hasselbach and Giesing, "you are not diplomats. You know that the Führer has implicit trust in Morrell, and that should not be shaken." When Hasselbach protested that any medical or even civil court could at least accuse Morrell of negligent bodily harm, Himmler turned abrasive. "Professor, you are forgetting that as Interior Minister, I am also head of the Supreme Health Authority, and I don't want Morrell to be brought to trial." The head of the SS dismissed Giesing's objection that Hitler was the only head of state in the world who took between 100